Imagine, like, legally manipulating a stock price to guarantee your bank doesn't lose a single dime on a bad deal. Sounds like a federal crime, right? Like a straight ticket to white-collar prison.
Yeah, you'd think so.
Well, today we are actually looking at the perfectly legal, highly regulated ways that Wall Street does exactly that.
It's really one of the most fascinating and, you know, tightly governed mechanisms in modern finance.
Absolutely. And we are going to tear it down piece by piece. But first, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 79 course with, you know, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Yeah, it's a great tool.
So check it out at CertFuel.com. Okay, let's unpack this. Today's session is, it's your absolute survival guide for function two of the Series 79 exam. We're talking about execution and distribution.
Right. And just to put that into context for the test, this section is a beast.
Oh, yeah.
It makes up like 27% of your exam.
Yeah.
Which translates to about 20 testable items.
That's huge.
Yeah. Chronologically speaking, we are looking at the frantic, high stakes, 2-week sprint between the kickoff of a roadshow and the final closing dinner of a public offering.
Right. So the registration is filed, the syndicate of banks is formed. And now the job is to actually sell the company to the public.
Mm-hmm.
But because this is the Series 79, I mean, this isn't just a sales manual. It's an absolute minefield of compliance traps.
Oh, totally.
It's about all the highly specific, highly illegal things you cannot do while selling. So to keep these abstract rules anchored in reality, because, you know, my ADHD brain needs it.
Same here.
We need some recurring characters. I want you, the listener, to picture these people vividly.
I love this approach because, you know, abstract rules only really stick when you attach them to human behavior. So who is our cast for today?
Okay, so first up, we have Frank, the founder.
Okay.
Frank is the ambitious, slightly clueless CEO of a tech startup. Let's say he invented Bluetooth-enabled socks.
Nice.
Highly disruptive, completely unnecessary. But, you know, Frank wants to take his company public.
Got it.
Next, we have Syndicate Sam. He's our stressed out bookrunner. He's the lead banker at the syndicate desk, whose entire livelihood depends on taking Frank's sock company public.
Right.
Without accidentally violating SEC rules and ending up in federal court.
A very critical distinction for Sam's career trajectory, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the buy side, we have two completely different investors. First, Fiona the Flipper.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, she runs a fast money hedge fund. Her entire strategy revolves around getting allocations of hot IPOs and dumping the stock on day one for a quick, like, 20% pop.
Right. She has zero loyalty.
Zero. And finally, we have Larry the Long Only. Larry manages a massive, boring, incredibly steady mutual fund. If Larry buys a stock, he's going to hold it until the sun burns out.
And, you know, the dynamic between Fiona and Larry is actually the gravitational pull for a huge chunk of the regulations we're going to cover today.
Really?
Yeah. Regulators and underwriters, they treat those two very differently.
Well, we will definitely get into that showdown. But before we even start the clock on the deal, I have a question for you listening. Answer this in your head right now. What is the single most important thing a bookrunner, our guy, Syndicate Sam, cares about when managing an offering?
Good question.
I'll give you a beat. Building a stable book. Keep that phrase glued to your prefrontal cortex. A stable book.
Yep.
Every single decision Sam makes is driven by that goal. So Frank has the sock. Sam has the mandate. Let's talk about the very first time this deal is pitched to a human being, the internal sales force.
Yes. So before the general public or outside investors ever see a prospectus, Syndicate Sam's banking team, they have to educate their own massive army of internal institutional and retail brokers.
Right.
The sales desk needs to know what they're actually selling. They need the investment thesis, the use of proceeds, the peer valuations.
Because they have to get on the phone.
Exactly. So to do this, the investment banking team drafts what is called an internal sales memo.
Okay. Here is where the test writers get sadistic. Listeners, pay attention. Let's say Sam's team writes this brilliant internal sales memo. It's got the pitch, the pricing, the whole cohesive story. One of Sam's retail brokers is on the phone with Fiona the Flipper, hyping up the deal.
Right.
Fiona says, "Sounds great. Shoot me over that memo you're reading from." The broker emails it to her. What happens?
Well, the broker gets fired and the firm faces a massive compliance breach. It is a strict violation of the Securities Act.
But wait, hold on. Why? If the memo is accurate and it tells the truth about Frank's company, why is it illegal to show it to Fiona? It's just a summary, right?
Well, it's because of how the SEC views written communication during an offering.
Okay.
The SEC heavily regulates what written materials can be shown to external investors. The internal sales memo is strictly for internal use. It's protected by the firm's information barrier policies.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, think of it as the banker's unfiltered cheat sheet.
Mm.
It might contain like optimistic projections or aggressive peer comparisons that have not gone through the rigorous, paralyzing legal vetting that a registered prospectus requires.
Ah, so it's the hype without the legal disclaimers?
Exactly. If you send it outside the firm, you're bypassing the external prospectus delivery rules. You are essentially distributing an unregistered prospectus.
Okay, so the core logic here is unvetted hype cannot leave the building. Internal means internal.
Right.
So how do we pitch Fiona then? What is the legally sanctioned way to take this show on the road?
We launch the actual road show, but the timeline here is critical for the exam. The road show launches after the preliminary prospectus is filed with the SEC.
After?
Yes, you absolutely cannot do this pre-filing. That is a massive violation called gun jumping.
Gun jumping, right.
Yeah.
And that preliminary prospectus has a very famous nickname, the red herring.
Yes, it does.
Why? Because it literally has a disclaimer printed in red ink on the cover stating that the registration statement is not yet effective. It's saying, hey, this is a draft. The SEC hasn't blessed this yet.
Exactly.
The red herring is filed, the roadshow launches, and it runs right up through the pricing of the deal.
Right. And the mechanics of the roadshow are actually really interesting. Syndicate Sam might be the mastermind, right? He might have spent the last 3 weeks coaching Frank on his posture and scripting his talking points.
Right, getting him media ready.
Yeah, but when they actually walk into the boardroom with Larry the Long Only, Sam sits quietly in the back. Frank, the founder, does the talking.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Sam is taking like 20% of the fees for structuring the deal, and he just sits there like a bump on a log.
Pretty much. Because investors don't want to hear from the banker. The banker is just a mercenary paid to sell the deal. Larry wants to look Frank in the eye and see if this guy actually knows how to run a Bluetooth sock empire.
That makes total sense. They're buying Frank, not Sam.
Exactly. And these presentations, they happen in a few different formats. You have intimate one-on-one meetings, which are strictly reserved for your anchor institutional accounts.
So that's Larry's.
That's Larry. A single successful one-on-one with a top-tier mutual fund can generate an order that covers like 15 to 25% of your entire offering.
Wow, that's massive efficiency. Just one meeting.
Yep.
So Larry gets the VIP sit-down. Where do the mid-tier players go?
Group lunches, group breakfasts at fancy hotels. That's for mid-size institutions and hedge funds like Fiona. Yeah. It's all about efficient throughput. You're pitching 30 accounts at once while they eat overpriced chicken.
Classic. So Frank is pitching his heart out at this group lunch.
Yeah.
Fiona is intrigued. She wants literature. She wants numbers in her hand to take back to her analysts.
Right.
What can Frank or Sam actually physically hand her?
Well, the red herring must always be available. If someone asks for it, you must provide it.
Okay, the draft prospectus.
Yeah. But let's say Frank wants to provide some extra written information that didn't make it into the red herring. Say, like, a custom slide showing market penetration or some newly updated data set.
Right. A slick handout.
Yeah. That extra paper must be filed with the SEC as a free writing prospectus or an FWP.
So you can't just, like, print out an Excel sheet in the hotel lobby and hand it out.
Absolutely not. If it's written and it's used to market the deal, it's an FWP and it must be filed.
Is there any exception to that?
The only other exception is a tombstone ad, which is just a bare bones, highly restrictive notice. It's basically just the name of the company, the security, and the underwriters. It doesn't contain a pitch.
Okay, so we know the materials, we know the venues. But how does Sam figure out who actually gets an invite to these roadshow meetings? I mean, you can't just blast an email to every fund manager in New York.
No, building the prospect list is arguably the most strategic part of the bookrunner's job.
Yeah, I always picture this like building a wedding guest list. If you are doing a follow-on offering, meaning Frank's company is already public, they've been trading for a year, and now they just want to issue more stock to build a new factory, you invite your current friends to the wedding.
Right.
You pull the 13D, 13G, and 13F filings.
Let's quickly define that for the listener. 13Fs are the quarterly scorecards that institutional investment managers with over $100 million in qualifying assets have to file.
Right.
It shows exactly what stocks they're holding. So, yes, you look at who already owns your stock and you call them first.
But for an IPO, like Frank's current situation, he doesn't have current public shareholders. He has venture capitalists and, like, his uncle.
Yeah.
So So what do? You invite people who went to similar weddings.
That's the perfect analogy. You look at the shareholders of comparable companies. If there's another wildly successful smart clothing startup out there, Sam's team will pull their 13F filings to see which mutual funds own them.
Oh, smart.
Yeah, because those funds already have a mandate, an appetite, and the analytical models for the sector. Pitching a fund that only buys heavy machinery would be a complete waste of a roadshow slot.
Right. They just wouldn't care about socks.
Exactly.
So Frank does the roadshow. He crushes it. People love the socks. Now we move into the phase where we actually start tallying the demand, building the book.
Yep.
This is where IOIs come in, indications of interest.
So the IOI book is Syndicate Sam's live ledger. It tracks exactly which investor wants how many shares, at what price they're willing to buy, and whether they are firm on that price or flexible.
Okay, I want to test the listener on this. Think about Fiona the flipper. She goes to the group lunch, loves Frank's pitch, and submits an IOI. She says, put me down for 5 million shares of Bluetooth socks at $20 a share. The deal price is the next week. Is she legally bound to wire the money and buy those shares? Take a beat.
It's a good trap.
Nope, not at all. IOIs are entirely non-binding. Either party can walk away, modify the amount, or change the price limit right up until the final price is officially set and the deal is declared effective.
Right. And because they are non-binding, Sam isn't just a human calculator counting up shares. He's a bouncer.
A bouncer. I like that.
Yeah, he's running screens. Before any final allocation is given out, Sam runs every single account through 3 pre-allocation screens.
Okay, what are they?
First is standard KYC and AML. Know your customer and anti-money laundering. Basic regulatory hygiene.
Sure.
Second is new issue eligibility, which is a massive compliance beast we will tackle shortly.
Yeah, wait.
But the third screen is the most subjective and the most critical for a successful IPO. Quality of account analysis.
Quality of account. Okay. This is the Fiona versus Larry showdown.
Yes, it is.
Let's set the hypothetical.
Yeah.
Fiona the flipper and Larry the long only both submit IOIs. They both want 1 million shares of Frank's stock at exactly $20. The demand is identical. The price is identical. Does Sam just split it 50-50?
Yeah.
Who does he prioritize?
Sam prioritizes Larry, and it's not even a close call.
Okay, I'm playing devil's advocate here. Why? 1 million shares is 1 million shares. Frank's company gets $20 million either way. Why does Sam care who writes the check?
Because Sam's job doesn't end when the check is cashed. Sam's reputation depends on the aftermarket longevity of the stock price.
Ah, keeping the book stable.
Exactly. Let's play out the Fiona scenario. If Sam gives 1 million shares to Fiona, what happens at 9:30 a.m. on trading day? She is a fast money flipper.
Right.
The second the stock opens at $22, she's going to dump all 1 million shares on the open market to lock in her 10% profit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that creates massive sudden downward selling pressure, which could trigger stop losses, cause panic, and crater Frank's stock price below the offering price on day one.
Which makes the IPO look like a disastrous failure in the financial press, and Frank never hires Sam's bank again.
Precisely.
Yeah.
But if Sam gives those 1 million shares to Larry, Larry puts them in his mutual fund vault and quite literally forgets about them for 5 years.
Right. He's long only.
Yeah. That restricts the available float of shares trading in the market. Less supply means the price stays stable or drifts upward. The bookrunner is actively curating the shareholder base that Frank's company will have to live with.
Okay, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So we've screened the accounts. We know who we want. Now we have to actually price this thing. We have all these IOIs giving us a beautiful demand curve. But Sam isn't just looking at the IOIs, right? He's not operating in a vacuum.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Sizing and pricing an IPO requires macro awareness. Sam is tracking the global economic data calendar. He's looking at upcoming CPI inflation prints, FOMC interest rate decisions, non-farm payroll reports.
Right.
If the Federal Reserve is scheduled to announce a highly anticipated interest rate hike at 2 p.m. on Thursday, Sam is absolutely not going to price Frank's IPO on Thursday afternoon.
Right, because you don't launch your fragile little IPO boat into a macroeconomic hurricane. You wait for the waters to calm.
Beautifully said.
Now, here is a massive conceptual trap for the exam. The idea of a covered book.
Oh, yeah. This gets people.
Let's say Frank's target price range on the red herring is $18 to $22. And Sam gets a flood of IOIs. He has enough demand to sell the entire offering at $22.
Okay.
The book is fully 100% covered at the top end of the range.
Yeah.
Let me ask the listener. Does that guarantee they will price the deal at $22?
Think about it.
It does not. And that is incredibly counterintuitive.
It really is.
It makes no sense. If people are banging down the door willing to pay 22, why on earth would Frank and Sam leave money on the table?
Because of the quality of account analysis we just discussed, let's say all the demand at $22 is coming from hot money hedge funds like Fiona.
Oh.
They don't care about the valuation, they just want momentum. But all your solid long-term anchor accounts, the Laris, they ran their discounted cash flow models and are refusing to pay more than $20. If you stubbornly price at $22 to maximize day one cash, you fill your book exclusively with Fionas.
And then they all rush for the exit on day one and the stock collapses to $15.
Exactly. A smart syndicate manager will often recommend pricing at the midpoint, say $20, to secure Larry's massive anchor demand and ensure aftermarket stability, even if they technically had enough hot money volume to price at the ceiling.
Okay, so who ultimately pushes the button? Sam is doing all this analysis, but who makes the final call?
The exam loves to test this chain of command. Syndicate Sam recommends the launch window, the offering size, and the final price. He advises.
Okay.
But Frank, the founder, representing the issuer, ultimately decides. The issuer has the final authority based on the underwriting agreement. Sam executes, but he does not dictate.
The issuer is the boss. Got it.
Yeah.
So Frank's IPO is priced. The shares are spoken for. But here's the million-dollar question. Sam didn't do this for charity. How exactly does that massive pool of investor money actually get sliced up before it hits Frank's bank account? We need to talk about the gross spread.
Yes, the gross spread. It's the total compensation the syndicate of banks keeps.
Right.
The formula is very straightforward. It's the public offering price, or POP, minus the net proceeds delivered to the issuer. So if Frank's stock goes public at $20 and Frank's company actually receives $18.60 per share, the gross spread is $1.40. That $1.40 per share is the underwriter's cut.
Okay, and Sam isn't keeping all of that $1.40 for himself. He built a whole syndicate of other banks to help distribute this stock. There's a standard market convention for how that spread is chopped up. It's not a strict SEC rule, but it's industry standard.
Right.
It's called the 20-20-60 split. Let's break down those buckets.
Sure. The first 20% is the management fee. That goes directly to Sam and any co-managers. It pays for the sheer brain work. Structuring the deal, running the book, drafting the S-1, determining the valuation.
So the architects get paid for the blueprints. What's the second 20%?
The underwriting fee. This is paid out to every syndicate member based on their specific capital commitment. It compensates them for the risk they are taking.
What kind of risk?
Well, if the deal suddenly tanks and they're stuck holding unsold inventory, or if they take losses trying to stabilize the stock in the aftermarket, this fee compensates them for putting their firm's balance sheet on the line.
Okay, so 20% for brains, 20% for risk. That leaves a massive 60% chunk.
The 60% is the selling concession, and this is the only variable component of the spread.
Meaning what?
Meaning it is paid out only on shares that are actually placed with an end buyer. If your specific firm finds the buyer and closes the sale, your firm gets the selling concession for those shares. It pays for the hustle.
I have to push back here. Wait, 60% just for selling it? That seems wildly disproportionate compared to the people who actually structured the deal and took the financial risk. Why does the sales desk get the lion's share?
Because without distribution, the deal dies. Placing millions of shares of an unproven company requires a massive, coordinated sales effort across hundreds of brokers. You have to heavily incentivize the retail and institutional distribution networks to pick up the phone and push this specific stock instead of the thousands of other products they could be selling.
Okay, that makes sense. Incentives drive outcomes. You got to pay the salespeople.
Exactly.
Now, speaking of other products, I want to go on a quick tangent because the exam will test this. Is this standard 7% or 8% total gross spread normal for everything? What if a broker is selling something really weird, like a direct participation program or an unlisted REIT?
Ah, that's a great distinction. Direct participation programs, or DPPs, and unlisted real estate investment trusts are highly illiquid alternative investments.
Right.
Because they are so hard to sell, the commissions can get historically abusive. So FINR stepped in with hard regulatory caps.
What are the numbers we need to memorize there?
Two numbers. FINRA presumes the compensation is unfair and unreasonable if the total organization and offering expenses, the O&O, exceed 15% of gross proceeds.
15% for O&O.
Right. And specifically, the maximum underwriter compensation cannot exceed 10% of gross proceeds.
15% for O&O, 10% for the underwriter. Jot those down, listener. Okay, back to Frank's IPO. The 60% selling concession. How does a bank actually earn it? The bookrunner separates the demand into two pools, retail and institutional.
Yes.
Start with retail. This uses a channel called free retention.
Free retention refers to shares that a syndicate member is allotted to sell through its own retail distribution channels. And the great thing about free retention for the bank is that if they sell those shares to their own retail clients, they keep the full selling concession. They don't have to split it.
Easy enough.
Yeah.
But what about the massive institutional orders? The Larrys and the Fionas buying millions of shares at once, those don't go through a retail broker at a strip mall. They go into something called the pot.
Right. The institutional pot is the central pool of shares controlled directly by the bookrunner. And the economics of the pot are usually structured in one of two ways. A fixed pot or a jump ball pot.
A fixed pot is boring. The 60% selling concession is just split up among the syndicate members based on a predetermined contractual schedule set before the deal even launches. Bank A gets 30%, Bank B gets 20%, whatever.
Right.
But a jump ball pot.
Right.
This is where Wall Street gets weird.
It really is. It's a fascinating mechanism for institutional leverage.
Right. So in a jump ball pot, Larry the Long only gets allocated 1 million shares. But Larry gets to designate which bank in the syndicate receives the selling concession credit for his order.
Yep.
But why does Larry care? Why would a mutual fund manager care which bank gets the commission?
Because Larry uses those commission dollars to pay for research. This is the concept of soft dollars.
Soft dollars, okay.
Let's say Bank B isn't the lead manager on the deal, but for the last 12 months, Bank B's biotechnology analysts have been sending Larry incredibly valuable proprietary research reports for free. Larry owes them.
So Larry sits on his throne and says, Sam's bank might be running this IPO, but I designate Bank B to get my concession credit. He uses Frank's IPO to pay off his debt to Bank B's research department.
Precisely. In a fixed pot, the syndicate members are paid merely for existing in the syndicate. In a jump ball pot, they are paid for being chosen by the buyer. It rewards the specific banks that provided the best day-to-day coverage and research to that institution.
Wow. So allocations are set. Who gets what is decided? But before Sam officially locks the allocation and finalizes the trades, he has to do two final checks.
Yes. Order verification and branch confirmation. Order verification is the mundane but vital process of checking the trade tickets against the master order log. You're looking for typos, stale tickets, and making sure the names match the KYC records.
Right.
Branch confirmation is for firms with massive retail networks. The branch managers literally confirm the allotments down the distribution chain to the individual brokers.
And if there is one thing Fonera loves to test, it's the timing. These checks happen before the allocation locks, not after. If you catch an error after the system locks, it requires a nightmare manual unwind through the compliance department. So verify before you lock.
Crucial point.
Okay, stop what you are doing. If you are zoning out, tune back in right here. Listeners, stretch your legs, drink some water. Because we are now entering phase four, the heavyweight.
The big ones.
This is the highest yield, most densely tested, most compliance trap-filled part of execution and distribution. These are the rules that stop people from cheating.
We are transitioning from market mechanics to strict regulatory enforcement. And we'll start with the new issue rule.
Let's do it. What is the underlying logic here? Why does this rule exist?
The new issue rule bars FINRA members from selling IPO shares of common stock to restricted persons. The entire point of the rule is to prevent industry insiders from front-running retail investors on hot IPOs.
So keeping it fair.
Yeah. If Frank's IPO is oversubscribed and guaranteed to pop, the SEC doesn't want the brokers hoarding all the shares for themselves and their buddies.
Okay, let's pause right there. I want the listener to catch a technicality. The rule says IPO shares of common stock. So what if Frank issues a secondary follow-on offering a year from now? Or what if he does an IPO of preferred stock? Are those covered?
Give him a second to think.
Right, no. Put a giant asterisk next to this in your notes. IPOs of common equity only.
Exactly.
Preferred stock is basically a fixed income instrument. It doesn't pop on day one, so there's no incentive to hoard it. The new issue rule is strictly for common equity IPOs.
Spot on. Now, who is a restricted person? It is a very broad net. It obviously includes broker-dealer personnel, owners of broker-dealers, and fiduciaries like the attorneys and accountants working on the deal.
Right, the insiders.
But the category that always catches people off guard on the exam is portfolio managers.
Wait, like Fiona?
Yeah.
Our hedge fund manager.
Yes. The rule sweeps in anyone with authority to buy or sell securities for a bank, insurance company, investment company, or hedge fund. Fiona manages a hedge fund. Therefore, Fiona is a restricted person.
But wait, earlier you said Fiona was submitting IOIs to buy Frank's stock. Is she banned from the IPO entirely?
She's banned from buying it for her personal account.
Ah.
Yeah, she can buy it for the hedge fund she manages because that benefits her outside investors. But the rule stops her from using her institutional clout to demand hot IPO shares for her own personal enrichment.
That makes perfect sense. And this rule doesn't just stop at the industry professionals. It sweeps in their immediate family members, spouses, parents, in-laws, siblings, children. But just being related to a broker doesn't automatically ban you, right? Like if my brother is a broker, am I banned?
Correct. There are nuances. For broker-dealer employees' relative, they are restricted if the employee provides material support to them.
Which means what?
MRED defines it as more than 25% of their income. They are also restricted if the relative lives under the same roof or if the employee actually controls the IPO allocation.
Okay, so with this massive web of restricted people, how does a broker-dealer actually prove to regulators that they aren't selling to them? I mean, how do they know?
They require the account holder to sign a written representation, an affirmative statement confirming they are eligible.
Right.
And here are your testable numbers. That representation must be refreshed every 12 months, not 13, not 14, 12 months. If a client's letter is 13 months old, you cannot allocate them shares, period.
Wow, that's strict.
And you have to keep those eligibility records on file for at least 3 years after their last new issue sale.
Okay, there is also a carve-out called the de minimis exemption. What's the magic number there, and why does it exist?
The number is 10%. An account can have restricted person ownership up to 10% and still be eligible to buy the IPO. Imagine Larry's massive mutual fund. There are thousands of investors in that fund. If a junior analyst at a broker-dealer happens to own shares of Larry's fund in his 401k, technically, a restricted person has an ownership interest in the fund.
Right.
Without the de minimis exemption, that junior analyst's tiny investment would block the entire billion-dollar mutual fund from participating in the IPO. So as long as restricted persons make up less than 10% of the fund's beneficial ownership, the fund can buy the IPO.
12 months, 3 years, 10%. Anchor those numbers to the story.
Bam.
All right, next heavyweight, Regulation M.
Reg M.
This is all about stopping the underwriters from manipulating the price of a stock before the deal prices.
Right. If we look at the mechanics, Reg M restricts distribution participants, meaning the underwriters, brokers, and their affiliates, from bidding for or buying the offered security in the open market during a specific restricted period.
How long is that?
The length of that restrictive period scales inversely with the liquidity of the security. We use a three-tier ladder.
Let's climb the ladder. Tier one, the big boys.
Yeah.
Actively traded securities. If the stock has an average daily trading volume, or ADTV, of at least $1 million, and a public float of at least $150 million.
What is the restricted period?
They are accepted. There is zero restricted period.
Wait, zero, nothing. Why does the SEC give them a free pass?
Because of the sheer size of the ocean. The market for a massive mega cap tech stock is so wildly liquid that an underwriter's trading desk couldn't manipulate the price even if they tried.
Like trying to boil the ocean with a lighter.
Exactly. Their bids would just be swallowed by the algorithmic noise. They're a drop in the ocean, so the SEC doesn't bother restricting them.
Okay, tier two, mid-cap securities. ADTV of at least $100,000 and a float of at least $25 million.
The restricted period is one business day before pricing.
And tier three, everything else, the small stuff.
Five business days before pricing.
Why a full 5 days? That seems like a long time to be shut out of the market. Because imagine a thinly traded microcap stock that only trades 50,000 shares a day. A single underwriter placing aggressive bids could completely artificially inflate the stock price right before the offering. It's incredibly easy to spoof the book.
Ah, I see.
So the SEC forces them to completely step away from the market for a full 5 calendar days to let the price settle naturally.
Okay, but I see a massive structural problem here.
Yeah.
What if Syndicate Sam's firm is not only underwriting the deal, but they are also a massive registered market maker on the NASDAQ for this specific stock.
Mm.
If they have to completely stop trading a mid-cap stock for a day or a small cap for 5 days, they drain vital liquidity from the market. Is there a loophole?
There is a highly regulated exception called NASDAQ passive market making. It allows the distribution participant to continue making markets during their restricted period, but, and this is vital, they can only be passive.
Passive means you are a follower, not a leader.
Exactly. Their bids are strictly capped at the highest independent bid. If an independent market maker bids $15, Sam's desk can bid $15. If the independent drops his bid to $14, Sam must immediately drop to $14.
So they can't lead the price up.
Right. Sam cannot independently raise the bid to $16 to drive the price up. Furthermore, there is a daily volume limit. Their net purchases cannot exceed the greater of 30% of their ADTV or 200 shares. Once they hit that volume limit, they must withdraw their quotes for the rest of the day.
Okay, so Reg M has the underwriters locked down.
Mm.
But Reg M also has a rule for investors, and it is absolutely brutal. The short sale rule.
Yes, this applies to anyone in the market, not just underwriters. The rule is simple. You cannot sell a stock short during the 5-day restricted period before pricing and then buy shares in the offering.
I need you to explain the scam here. Why is that banned?
Well, think about the fundamental mechanics of a short sale. You borrow a stock and sell it at today's high market price, hoping it goes down so you can buy it back cheaper later.
Right.
If you know a company is about to do a follow-on offering at a discounted price, you could short the stock at $25 during the restricted period. Then the offering price is at $20. You buy the offering shares at $20 and use those heavily discounted shares to immediately cover your $25 short.
Oh, wow. You just locked in a guaranteed risk-free $5 profit?
Exactly. The SEC views that as highly manipulative because your short selling actually depresses the market price right before the company tries to raise capital.
You're actively sabotaging the company's offering to guarantee your own arbitrage profit.
Mm-hmm.
So they ban you from buying the offering if you shorted it in the 5 days prior?
Yep.
And here is the exam trap flag. Listeners waving it wildly. This rule is strict liability. What does that mean for Fiona?
Strict liability means intent is entirely irrelevant. Let's say Fiona's quantitative hedge fund algorithm automatically shorts Frank's stock on a Tuesday, completely unrelated to the upcoming offering. It's just a statistical arbitrage trade.
Okay, totally innocent.
On Wednesday, Frank announces a follow-on offering. Fiona loves it. She wants to participate. She cannot. It does not matter that she didn't intend to manipulate the offering. The fizzle act of shorting during the restricted period mathematically bars her from buying the offering.
Brutal, but crystal clear. Okay, we've priced the deal, we've navigated Reg M without going to jail. Now Frank's stock is trading on the open market. Welcome to phase 5, the safety nets, green shoe, and stabilization.
This is where we answer the question we opened the show with. How does an underwriter legally support a falling stock price without getting arrested for market manipulation?
Right, because normally, artificially propping up a stock price is a federal crime.
Huge crime.
But the SEC carved out two very specific exceptions to ensure orderly capital markets. The first one is the green shoe, formerly known on the exams the overallotment option. Let's give the hard numbers first.
Right.
Maximum size is 15% of the base offering, and the exercise window is typically 30 days.
Right, 15% and 30 days. But understanding how it works mechanically is much more important than just memorizing those numbers.
Okay, let's walk through it slowly. Say Frank is offering 10 million shares. Sam has a 15% green shoe option baked into the legal underwriting agreement. When Sam allocates the shares to investors, he doesn't just sell 10 million shares. He intentionally oversells the deal. He allocates 11.5 million shares to Larry, Fiona, and the rest of the market.
Exactly. By overselling the deal by 1.5 million shares, Sam's syndicate has intentionally created a naked short position. They owe the market 1.5 million shares that they do not currently possess.
Wait, they literally short the stock they're underwriting?
Yes.
Normally, a short seller would panic here. They need to find shares. So the stock opens for trading. Scenario A, the stock pops. It's a huge success. It goes from the $20 offering price up to $25. Sam is short 1.5 million shares. How does he cover without losing millions of dollars?
He exercises the green shoe option. Sam goes to Frank, the founder, and says, Frank, the stock is doing great. I am exercising my option.
Well, what does Frank do?
Frank's company authorizes and issues 1.5 million brand new shares to Sam at the original $20 offering price. Sam takes those shares and uses them to flatten his short position.
Brilliant. Frank gets extra capital, Sam gets extra commissions, and the market price isn't affected at all because Sam didn't have to go buy 1.5 million shares on the open market at $25.
Exactly. But let's look at scenario B, which is why the green shoe really exists.
The nightmare scenario.
Yeah. The stock drops. It opens at $20 and immediately starts sliding to $19, $18. Fiona is dumping her shares. Everyone is panicking. What does Sam do now?
Does he exercise the option?
He does not exercise the green shoe. Frank doesn't issue any new shares. Instead, Sam covers his 1.5 million share short position by actively buying shares in the open market. This is formally called a syndicate covering transaction.
And this is the magic trick. By stepping in and buying 1.5 million shares in the open market, Sam creates massive buying pressure, which acts as a safety net to catch the falling stock price.
Yeah.
And here is the crazy part. Because he is buying shares in the market at $18, to cover a short he effectively sold at $20, the syndicate actually makes a $2 per share profit on the spread.
True.
That profit offsets the reputational damage of a busted IPO.
It is an incredibly elegant mechanism. The syndicate is financially protected in both directions, and the issuer gets vital price support if the stock sags.
But wait, what if the green shoe isn't enough? Can Sam just place bids wherever he wants to stop the bleeding?
No. If Sam needs to place a formal stabilizing bid to peg or fix the price, there are incredibly strict rules. The absolute golden rule for the exam. A stabilizing bid can only be placed at or below the offering price.
Let me repeat that because it is vital. At or below. A stabilizing bid can never be used to push the price UP above the offering price. Why?
Because the goal is to prevent a free fall, not to create a fake rally. Furthermore, the bid is capped at the lower of the offering price, or the highest independent bid in the principal market.
Can they place, like, multiple bids at once?
No, you are only allowed to have one stabilizing bid active at a time. If the syndicate placed multiple bids at different price levels, it would create the illusion of fake market depth. And Sam must formally notify the market that it is a stabilizing bid and must keep records of it for 3 years.
3 years record keeping. Got it. Now, what about Fiona? Let's trace this back. She got allocated shares at $20 and immediately flipped them at $19.90, which is exactly what caused the stock to drop and forced Sam to stabilize in the first place. Did she just get away with ruining the IPO?
She gets away with her quick trade, yes. But the broker who sold her the shares gets severely punished via a penalty bid.
Ah, love this part. How does that work?
When Fiona's flipped shares are bought back by the syndicate during their covering transaction, Sam's system traces the serial numbers of those shares back to the specific retail broker or syndicate member who originally allocated them to her.
Oh, they trace it back?
Yep. And Sam reclaims the entire selling concession from that broker.
So if a retail broker gave Fiona the shares, hoping to earn a juicy $10,000 commission, and she flips them, Sam snatches the $10,000 right back out of the broker's pocket.
Exactly. It forces brokers to be incredibly careful about who they allocate to. It perfectly aligns their financial incentives with finding long-term holders like Larry rather than fast money flippers.
Okay, we are rounding third base. Phase 6, customer protection listing.
Yeah.
The deal is done, the shares are allocated, but the SEC has to make sure the retail investors didn't get totally hosed by overly aggressive brokers.
This is where we look at the standard of care applied to the end customer. For a long time, the standard across the board was the FNRA suitability rule.
Right, which means a broker must have a reasonable basis to believe a recommendation is suitable for a specific customer based on their profile, age, net worth, risk tolerance.
Yes. And for institutional clients like Larry and Fiona, that suitability rule is still the standard. In fact, there is an institutional exemption. If the broker reasonably believes the institution is capable of evaluating risk, and the institution affirmatively indicates they are exercising independent judgment, the broker is legally off the hook for customer-specific suitability.
They're big boys and girls, they can do their own math. But what about retail investors? What about a retired school teacher buying 100 shares of Frank Socks?
For retail, the standard was significantly elevated in 2020 by Regulation Best Interest, or REGBI.
REGBI, it has four component obligations: disclosure, care, conflict of interest, and compliance.
The conflict of interest obligation is the one FINRA loves to test. Under the old suitability rules, you could often just disclose a conflict of interest in the fine print and move on. Under REGBI for retail customers, if a broker has a financial incentive tied to a specific product, like a massive bonus for selling Frank's stock over a competitor's, the firm must actually mitigate that conflict, not just disclose it.
Yeah, they have to actively fix it.
Yes. And certain things like sales contests or quotas for specific securities are banned outright.
To accompany REGBI, the SEC created Form CRS, the Customer Relationship Summary. It's a standardized disclosure form. And here is a major exam trap flag regarding Form CRS. How does the SEC define a retail investor for this specific form? Is it based on how much money they have?
It is not tied to net worth. That is the trap. A retail investor is defined simply as any natural person seeking services primarily for personal, family, or household purposes.
Let me make sure I understand this. If a literal billionaire walks into a brokerage to open a personal account to buy stocks for his own private portfolio, he is legally a retail investor for Form CRS purposes.
Absolutely. Even if he is an accredited investor, a qualified purchaser, and owns a yacht. For Form CRS, he is retail and must receive the form.
And what are the physical rules for the form?
It is strictly capped at 2 pages. You can't bury the disclosures in a 50-page legal brochure. And it must be delivered to the retail investor at the earliest of 3 triggers. A recommendation of an account type, placing an order, or opening an account.
The earliest, not just when the ink is dry on the order. Okay, the very last hurdle. Exchange listing and NSMIA preemption. Frank wants his Bluetooth sock company listed on a major exchange so people can actually trade it. But he can't just ask nicely. Let's do a quick numbers game between the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ Global Select. Make Frank sweat.
For an IPO to list on the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE, it needs 400 round lot holders. A round lot is 100 shares. So you need 400 separate investors holding at least 100 shares each. It needs 1.1 million publicly held shares in the float, a $40 million aggregate market value, and a minimum share price of $4.
Okay, my mnemonic for this. 400 holders, 1.1 million shares, $40 million value, $4 price, the fours and ones. What about NASDAQ Global Select?
NASDAQ is slightly different. They require 450 round lot holders, but they offer an alternate path. 2,200 total holders, regardless of lot size. They require 1.25 million shares, $45 million in value, and again, a $4 minimum price.
So NASDAQ demands slightly more shares and value $1.25 million and $45 million compared to NYSE's 1.140, but both require that baseline $4 share price. No penny stocks allowed on the big boards.
Correct. And keep in mind, these numerical thresholds are necessary, but not sufficient. Both exchanges also have stringent financial tests for earnings or cash flow and qualitative rules for corporate governance, like having independent directors.
Let's assume Frank hits all the numbers. He rings the bell. Once Frank is officially listed on the NYSE or NASDAQ, a magical piece of hurdle legislation kicks in. NSMIA, the National Securities Markets Improvement Act. What does this do for Frank?
NSMIA is essentially a treaty between the federal government and the individual states. It says that if a security is listed on a national exchange, it becomes a covered security. And for covered securities, federal law preempts state registration requirements.
Meaning, Frank doesn't have to fill out distinct registration paperwork and pay filing fees in all 50 separate states just to have his stock legally trade in those states. It eliminates the dreaded blue sky paperwork duplication.
Exactly. It creates a unified national market. However, the exam will test the exception. What power do the states retain?
States always, always keep their anti-fraud authority.
Yes. NSMIA preempts registration, not enforcement. A state regulator can't block Frank's offering for failing to file a state-level form. But if Frank lies to investors at a roadshow in Texas, the Texas authorities can absolutely still sue him for fraud.
Beautiful. The state always keeps its teeth for fraud. Okay, we made it through the two-week sprint. It is time for the rapid-fire recap.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to demand the top testable numbers we covered today, and I want you to fire them right back at me.
Ready. Let's do it.
Green shoe option.
Maximum 15% of the base offering. Standard 30-day exercise window.
Red gem short sale rule.
5 business days before pricing. Strict liability. Intent does not matter.
Restricted persons under the new issue rule.
Must refresh written representation every 12 months. De minimis exemption is capped at 10% ownership.
Stabilization record keeping.
3 years minimum, with the first 2 years easily accessible.
And the weird one we threw in the middle. Direct participation programs in unlisted REITs.
Presumptions of unfairness. Organization and offering expenses above 15% of gross proceeds and total underwriter compensation capped at 10% of gross proceeds.
Boom. Memorize those numbers. Tie them to Frank and Fiona.
If I can leave the listener with one final provocative thought to mull over tonight.
Please do.
We just spent this entire deep dive going through a mountain of rules, Reg M, the new issue rule, stabilization caps, and they're all ostensibly designed to prevent manipulation and ensure fair pricing for the public. But ask yourself this. If the green shoe option and syndicate stabilization are literally government-sanctioned price manipulation mechanics explicitly designed to protect the underwriter from taking a loss, who is really carrying the ultimate risk in a public offering? Is it the mass investment bank, the founder? Or is it the retail buyer jumping in on day two, assuming the market is entirely free?
Wow. Okay, that is something to think about while you review your flashcards. A perfectly rigged game that's perfectly legal. Remember, building a stable book is the name of the game, and keeping Sam out of federal prison is the goal. You are now armed and dangerous for function 2 of the Series 79. Good luck studying, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.